Living Room Conversations enable people to come together through their social networks as friends and their friends to engage in a self-guided conversation on an agreed-upon topic. Typically, the conversations have self-identified co-hosts who hold differing views, and they may or may not be from different ethnic groups, socioeconomic backgrounds, or political parties. You get the idea. Each host invites two of their friends to join the conversation, and participants follow an easy-to-use format that offers structure and a set of questions for getting acquainted with each other and each other's viewpoints. Conversations, we find, foster new relationships, and they often reveal surprising common ground. The vision for Living Room Conversations is a world in which people who have fundamental differences of opinion and backgrounds work together with respect and even joy to realize the vibrant future we all desire. Living Room Conversations are special because people agree to follow six simple ground rules. It's all stuff we learned in kindergarten, but here's a real quick reminder. Number one, be curious and open to learning. Number two, show respect and suspend judgment. Number three, look for common ground. Number four, be authentic and welcome that from others. Number five, be purposeful and to the point. And number six, own and guide the conversation. So basically, no soapboxing, listen well, and be authentic. And if you look for common ground, people often find it. Enjoy your very own Living Room Conversation.
We all love our children, and we want our community to be safe. We've seen tragedy in our communities, and we want that to end. We all want law enforcement to be fair, and we want a police to be able to do their job in a manner that's safe for them and the community. So let's start with this as a given. Over the last year, policing has become a major point of discussion as violence across racial lines has provoked racial tension. Too often, the conversation remains paralyzed in fear or anger, with people unable to share deeply considered feelings and perspectives. So we're hoping that these conversations today will contribute to a thoughtful exploration on this question. Welcome to our Living Room Conversations team as we get started on this conversation today. We're going to do a little adaptation from our normal conversation. We're going to collapse rounds one and two about why we're here and a little bit about our core values so that we can get right to the heart of the matter in round three and talking about police and community relations. First of all, let's just talk a little bit about what drew us or interested us in this conversation, then something about your hopes and concerns for the future. I'm going to kind of do a little bit of a round robin here. And Jacob, I'd like to start with you today.
Sounds good. Thank you. I'm interested in this maybe for similar reasons. Many Americans it's right in our face. We see it, the violence happening. They need to react, one event against another. And I'm personally convinced that the kind of conversations we're swimming in as a country play all sorts of indirect and indirect roles in shaping not just how we think about those Americans that disagree with us or who are different than us, but what we actually do and how we act in response. And I found a lot of optimism working with those, with you on the call. It's just an engine of hope for me that we can find it across some pretty fundamental differences. Enjoyment, intimacy, respect, learning, fun, then maybe it's possible for others in our country. So this feels like a practice that I really care about for personal reasons, for what it's done for my life, and also just looking towards the future. This is a part of my hope that this is possible, and because I've lived it with those of you on the call, and that's really why I'm here.
Thanks, Jacob. John, would you like to go next, please?
Thank you. The conversation today is in response to a week where we've just been getting news that's been heartbreaking with loss of life in different parts of the country, community of color, and police officers. And I have a friend from Serbia who has reminded me that things went south in Serbia when law enforcement and the communities that they were policing totally lost trust with each other. And that loss of trust is something that there are many, many good people throughout the country that want to heal. And I think it's just vital that we take advantage of that desire and make the system work in a way that works well for everybody to restore the trust. And there's just a vast amount of things to say about that, but that's in the next round. So I will leave it at that.
Thanks so much, John. John, what interested you in this conversation, and what are your hopes and concerns?
I think we all share a horror with what's been happening, both in blue and black, if you will, to the different communities and the division. I've been particularly fired up in two very different ways. One is with the core problem of violence and in our communities and the criminal justice problem and how it's really not balanced at all in terms of people who have to resort to violence or live in these dangerous areas. And the dangers that policemen have in trying to protect and defend, and all the good actors and the few bad actors. I'm also, the core problem affects me like everybody else. I almost want to say enraged by the tendency of a media and politicians to have a tendency, not necessarily doing too badly, but some cases are, of making it worse because they earn votes and earn money by being the most explosive and explosive responses to that. But I will also say I was very encouraged by former President Bush and Barack Obama coming together to speak at Dallas, and there's some great examples of people deciding to combat the fear and divisiveness. So I'm hoping to understand the problem better and see ways to get through there.
Thank you, John. Katie, weigh in
here. Thank you. I'm interested in this conversation because not only the events of the past week are appalling and horrific, but it's years and years and years and years of intense scarring in this nation. And I think it's kind of brought these issues to a head, but it's not as simple as police on community violence or community on police violence. It's so much more complicated than that. There are a lot of different things that play into this issue. And I had heard the other day, like, how far in this conversation are we willing to go? Like, are we willing to peel back the scab of intense systemic racism in this country? And I'm hoping to help forward the movement to becoming more harmonious in this country. And I guess that kind of touches on my hopes and concerns for the community where, you know, everyone feels comfortable. Police, people of color, I want everyone to feel safe in this community, and the people who are protecting us aren't protecting a certain community. So I'm hoping to start some new conversations that can help heal the wound and open up doors, and I'm in with that.
Great. Thanks, Katie. Ralph.
Thank you, Debbie Wynn. As the resident paleo conservative, and for the uninitiated, that means ultra hard right winger in the group, paleo conservatives are above all committed to human dignity. And I'd like to just anchor my comments on two points. Number one is President Obama made a very wonderful statement at his press conference in Poland. He had a long interaction with the media about this. And he made the point, and I want to underscore this point, that in fact and in truth, things are getting better. Progress is slow, slower than I would like, slower than he would like. The endemic racism that is fraught in our society is a scandal and a sin. And yet the number of civilians who are killed by the police each year is dropping consistently in a long-term trend and continues to drop. The number of police who are killed in the line of duty is also dropping in a long-term trend and is at the lowest level that it has ever been. So I want to inject the larger context that we are making progress. And although it's hard to see, and although a single death, a single hate crime is unacceptable, I am not nearly as despairing as some other people are, because if you look at the long-term mortality and morbidity indexes, things are absolutely getting better, and there's no question about that. We want to accelerate a process, not reverse a negative trend. The second thing is that I believe that the cries of rage and outrage on the indignities that are being perpetrated, both against the African-American community and people of color in general, and against the police, who are themselves a marginalized community, so long as it doesn't boil over into physical or social violence, killings, riotings, or lootings. But the expression of outrage and rage is part of the healing process, and we should not recoil from that, but we should engage with that and let people be heard, because there have been major injustices and major indignities perpetrated and are still being perpetrated against marginalized communities, both people of color and our cops. And I want to get their voices out there, because if we say, you know, let's be civil, I think that's premature. I think the expression of rage and outrage, so long as it doesn't boil over into violence, is part of the healing process.
Thank you, Ralph. And this is Debbie Lynn. And what interested me in this conversation, it's actually interested me for a long time, but there's something in me that shifted last week, the killings of two black men at the hands of police and then the five police officers being shot in Dallas. Something shifted in me because there are so many overlapping issues that we seem to not be addressing, you know, or at least not addressing fast enough, in my opinion, and it's indicative of our systemic, not just racism, but dysfunction that's happening in this country. My empathy for what black people are experiencing in America increased 100-fold last week. And I don't know why it took that event, but there was something in my heart that was both broken and broken open in response to the tragedy. And it is compelled me to action and to have conversations with my fellow white Americans of European descent to help root out the racism. And that really is my kind of hope for the future, because I'm having conversations this week that I couldn't have had 2 weeks ago. And that is providing me with tremendous hope that we will move forward and hopefully at a faster pace. And so that's why I'm here and where my hopes are for the future right now. We're going to move into the actual topic itself, not that we haven't touched on it. And this is just remembering that we're all here to listen and learn, and we're going to have different opinions and shared interests. So we're going to answer one or more of the following questions. And these are starter questions, so if there's a different question you actually want to answer, tell us the question first. We actually have 7 questions today. What has been your personal response to instances of police citizen shootings recently, if any? What do you think is contributing to the police citizen shootings right now? What role, if any, do you see racism playing in our current attention to law enforcement? What do you expect from law enforcement? What should communities do to support law enforcement? When you watch a video of an arrest, what do you think is happening? And the last question here is, what will it take for trust to grow between police and local communities? So those are some jump-off questions here, and feel free to, as I said, ask your own question. And I'm going to start this time with Joan.
Okay. I guess I'm going to start with, what do I expect from law enforcement? I have expected protection from law enforcement, and that they are going to make my community safer. And it has been a growing understanding that I'm in a very fortunate position where I can expect that from law enforcement because I have friends, very close friends, that don't have that expectation at all. And listening to them has caused me to have my eyes open. One of my husband's best friends has essentially said the police are just legally sanctioned gang in his experience of them, which I find horrifying. This is someone I love and trust. And I also have, you know, very, you know, almost extended family that are police officers. And I know that these people, what they want to do more than anything is protect and serve. So I, you know, knowing the human beings in both spaces, I feel like there's this disconnect that is it's like a tragedy playing out before our eyes. And I am searching for the interventions that will allow us to realize the outcome that we all want. I actually thought a recent Black Lives Matter pledge that I got was really quite beautifully done. And it was about our dreams, not about the anger. It says, we pledge togetherness. We will not allow ourselves to be divided. We pledge to allow our thinking and actions to be guided by love. We pledge to bring courage and power into our communities and stop their flow out. We pledge not to be controlled by fear, but instead by our dreams. That's a beautiful aspirational pledge in my mind. And it feels like something that most people would certainly agree to. And I hope that we can keep on our shared vision, because I think we all do want this outcome, and there's just such disbelief for some people that haven't had the experience and don't have the close friends that have had bad experiences with police. It's hard to think that this group of people that you know, for your life learned to trust, you know, when you were a child, you were told if you need help, go to a policeman. Now you are realizing that's not true for everyone, and that's, I think, hard for some people to accept. And that's where we want to be, where everybody in every community can say that. And a police person it will be, too. Not just the policemen, because it was policemen when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So that's my first thought.
Thanks, John. John Cable.
I'm very happy to hear that positive aspiration that Joan described from Black Lives Matter. I have been struggling my own mind of what, practically speaking, works. And even though I'm not sure if I agree with all of Rudy Giuliani's comments of late, it was interesting that when he became mayor, the crime rate in New York was very high. He was a huge supporter of the police and got a lot of money for the police and started enforcing the law more, and also let go and dismissed more policemen than had been done for a long, long, long time. The idea of supporting the police and expecting higher standards of accountability go hand in hand, while I think the general perception is that they go against each other. And so my initial uneducated thought about that is that might be a better approach. I'm concerned about other communities where the reaction is almost always a negative to police. I'm concerned that when something happens in San Francisco, there's always it always seems like the police are on defense when they're trying to help. So it seems that there's a lot of reactionary things that make it hard to do the right thing. You don't want to make police lives filled with bureaucracy. You want them to be able to protect people, and you want to train them on how to do that in difficult situations so that they can protect people of all of all colors, of all stripes, of all situations. And I'm wondering the best way to get there so that the marginalized people in our community can see them as a resource rather than a threat. I'm not quite clear on that, but some groups seem to have an anti-police feel, some groups have a overly, whatever police do is okay, like the police unions have. I was reading an article on, you know, police unions sometimes make it difficult for them to do a good job. It seems that some balance of the two, where you have both the respect for the law and everybody talks about that and says, yes, that's important, and we hold people accountable to a higher standard, is my uneducated gut feel on a practical step forward in terms of what to do. But I want to echo what Ralph said earlier, that we need to talk not just logically proactive activities, but voice our concerns and emotional fears. We've got to go through that. And perhaps even if it is a little bit better in reality today than it was before, although actually the shootings seem to have gone down, the aggressive violence towards, or aggressive maneuvers by police, the data suggests it's actually gone up a little bit, that all those shootings have gone down. But regardless, it is top of people's minds, and that gives us an opportunity to hopefully address it.
Thanks, John. And Katie?
Kind of going to bounce around a little bit. I had touched on a bit earlier that I think these issues go so far past just shooting. I mean, when the first thing that comes to mind when I look at these kind of issues is prison. African Americans make up 14% of the population, and they constitute 1 million out of 2.3 million incarcerated in our country. I mean, that is a staggeringly disproportionate amount of people. And there's, I think, a lot of different reasons for that. And I think the police focus too hard on a certain group of people in certain areas when white people are using just as much drugs and committing way more crime. There's obviously something going on there. And I expect law enforcement to be honest, and I don't think they're honest. And it's very hard for me to respect law enforcement when I feel like they're out to protect themselves, and that they're held to a different standard as citizens and people of color. I do want to support law enforcement, but I don't know how to do that if they're not going to be honest and partake in a truthful conversation about what is really going on. I wish someone else investigated these events other than law enforcement. Seems like a pretty broken system to me, and I just lost my train of thought. I do just so disproportionately, people of color are targeted, and I think that is an obvious. And I agree with what Ralph had said earlier, that shootings have gone down, but there are other issues that are not going to let this go so easily. So I will start with that.
Thanks, Katie. Ralph?
Well, first of all, I want to reinforce something that Katie said, because she's exactly right. And it's not just shootings. As I shared with our little community, a very eloquent piece by Shep Ferry about the traumatic abuse he experienced at the hands of the police repeatedly. And he's white, okay? And there's a friend of mine named Jeff Tucker, who is the chief liberty officer at liberty.me, who was arrested and badly maltreated by the police. And maybe it takes shootings to get people's attention, but there's an endemic problem here. That said, John Gable spilled the beans. John, I don't know who authorized you to tell the truth, but it's out there, no bringing it back here. And you made the most profound and profoundly overlooked point that I've heard on this topic yet. And that was when you referenced the transformation of the police under Mayor Giuliani. And I'm not a Giulianista, but this is just true. When I worked as an official in the Reagan White House, I had the privilege of working with a lot of people who were deeply immersed in law enforcement. And an open secret known to them and not denied, but to which very little attention is paid. The police respond to the directives of the police commissioner, and the police commissioner responds to the directives of the mayor. The pivot point, the fulcrum on this lever, are the mayors of America. If the mayors of America were to be pressured by the citizens of their cities to upgrade the status, the integrity of the policing process to the point where cops are treated well and they're held to account. And bad behavior is not tolerated and good behavior is rewarded. It can dramatically, quickly, and profoundly shift the culture in the police departments and shift the relationships between the police and the civilians and shift the level of both security and harmony in which we live. This is something that hardly anybody talks about, but it is a demonstrable fact. So, John, you let the cat out of the bag.
Any more, Ralph?
Probably, but that's all for now.
Okay, thanks. I do want to make a point here in our conversation that everyone on the phone here is a white American or of European descent. And so our perspective that we're sharing today is literally from our own experience. And I found it interesting when I both talked with an elder in my family the other day, telling her about how the events of this last week have really impacted me, and that I've known there's been systemic racism in our communities for a long time, not just in policing, but in housing and job searches and all that. But I didn't grok it or get it on that deeper level until the events of this past week. And she responded with an expression of fear that she was very afraid of what was happening and that there's all these people starting to riot and we just needed to find a way to get the blacks to cool down. And for me, it was both shocking to hear that the solution offered for dealing with systemic racism was to tell people to just stay cool about it and not have that outrage, Ralph, that you were talking about earlier that is so needed. And I often hear people talk about folks that they know that have been arrested, and they don't believe in police brutality or that it happens, and you know that there's this inhumane treatment of people who are being arrested until it happens to somebody who's white. And it's kind of like folks who are African American have been saying these things for centuries, decades, and yet we, the white community, don't believe them until it happens to somebody who's white. And so these are kind of are some of the things in my thinking that is shifting about how do we actually treat each other with dignity and respect, regardless of circumstances. Like, we're fellow human beings, and how can a police officer who is just fed up with somebody who's given him lip be respectful to this person who he thinks is a criminal, may or may not, you know, given that we're innocent until proven guilty. And I see that as a huge challenge. And personally, I don't know if I can do it. And yet, we know that part of what's happening is that we expect police to have more power to control the situation, to keep us safe. And yet it's that very power imbalance that sets up the indignities that people who are arrested or incarcerated or get into the system somehow experience. And to me, this is just part of the paradox of this wicked problem that we have. Not to mention then just our own awareness of somebody has told me something and do I believe them? Why or why not? And I am so happy that I'm awake, more awake now than I was before. I think I was pretty awake before, but definitely on a different level now. And increasing my empathy, if you will, for my neighbors who have had a different experience than me. I'm going to pause there and go to Jacob, and we'll do some few minutes of open sharing after Jacob.
Thanks, everyone. When you mentioned the challenge in your sharing just now, what challenge are you referring to? You said, I'm not sure I'm up to the challenge.
I was actually referring to, like, if I had to be in a position of authority because I'm protecting the public, and I think the person in front of me is out of balance or has committed some crime and they're talking back at me and being disrespectful to me, I'm not sure I would be up for the challenge of treating them with dignity and respect.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. I've been thinking about what you said earlier in the call, Debbie-Lynn, about this thing that shifted in you. I've been struck by things this week, like the congressman who or the senator, the African-American conservative senator who shared how many times he's been taken to be a troublemaker. That was pretty striking. But I haven't experienced, like, the shift you described, probably because I'm just not as awake, not as ready to be enlightened, teasing you a little bit. But speaking seriously, like, I've been thinking about why haven't I experienced that level? I was thinking about an experience in my marriage with Monique. Early on in my marriage, we really got into this pattern of being angry all the time at each other. It was like this constant, chronic resentment. We probably all experienced that in relationships. One thing I noticed is when we are in that place, any little thing either of us is doing can become like this big problem and headache, and we immediately interpret it to be a reflection of, you ascribe the worst possible intention to very little things. And so I think one reason, as I look inside myself, that I'm having a different emotional response is, ever since Ferguson, I have been alarmed, similar to John, at the way our media environment seems to incubate what is called in the academic world microaggressions, and like this hypersensitivity where it's almost inviting all of us to get into that same emotional chronic resentment. And just from my own experience in my marriage or with some friendships that have gone sour, in my mind, that's one of our biggest threats. And I'm one of the people who would fear a lot more a mobocracy, like a rampant sort of racially driven violence on both sides, just spiraling out of control. Like my nightmare is President Obama gets assassinated and they just spark riots everywhere. And if that happened, I would attribute a lot of the blame to a media environment that has like primed the pump for so long and sort of laying this foundation of a narrative in which we're all swimming that's just setting us up. And so this might sound naive. It might sound as naive as your friend, but when I think about like how to get to the root of that, I can't help but think about the New Testament teaching of this quality that we can cultivate, this other thing we can cultivate, where we're believing all things, hoping all things, enduring all things, and like literally not being as easily provoked and offended. I know that sounds like crazy and even maybe victim blaming and all this, but if we can't do that, I'm not sure all of the diversity trainings in the world that try to sensitize people like me to privilege and raise our sensitivity to microaggressions, I just don't have confidence. I've been through those programs. I'm not sure that they're going to get at the root of changing the dynamics. I've felt that love and appreciation in our team because of like the work we've done together. I'm just thinking until that heart dynamic shifts, I'm not sure all the policies are going to get us to a safer place. And I think we're on the verge of much worse rioting and violence. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. So I share some of the fear of your neighbor and maybe even some of her naivety. And what I think could help. That's all.
Thanks, Jacob. I want to share one thing that I got in my email box this morning. It just seems so poignant for this conversation today. The title is Galileo Plus Cognitive Dissonance. And this is what my experience is right now of a large part of the white community. It's certainly where I was until the events of this past week. And it's the three sentences here. It says, when Galileo invited Christian scholars to look through his telescope in order to see the new evidence, they flatly refused. They didn't want to see any data that might count against the Earth-centric view of the universe. It was difficult to think of a more revelatory episode of cognitive dissonance. They simply shut their eyes. And I witnessed this in an online video this week where there was a woman, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name, speaking to an all-white audience. And she asked the members of the audience to stand up, if they were willing to be treated in the same manner that our society treats African Americans, to stand up, you are willing to be treated in the same way they are. And no one in the audience stood up. And I think that is part of what opened my heart to this, to have empathy. It's not about feeling guilt or shame or, white privilege, acknowledging that white privilege exists without taking on that it means something else other than I've been blessed to be born in white skin, and so I had a sense of safety and societal ease that people with darker skin don't have. And it's just kind of that acknowledgement for me. So I just want to put that into the mix now. Go ahead and hit one on your keypad if you want to contribute next. We're going to do a little freeform for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll start into our closing. John, go ahead.
So I was so moved by so many different things. I think Katie is correct about it's a much, much bigger issue. Criminal justice is part of it. I think there is a culture that comes from there. And also a culture that devalues the rule of law in many cases, and also a culture that devalues education in many cases. There is a horrible societal fact that people of color are more likely to be criminals, and I don't mean in the kind of criminal justice, put them in jail for smoking something, but are in society, in cultures that where there is more violence and criminal behavior. I remember hearing Jesse Jackson talk once about he was walking in the street and was concerned because he heard steps behind him, and he turned around and saw a white man, and he was relieved, and he said, oh my gosh, what a horrible reality that is. And I'm actually tying lots of different things together. You know, teachers under attack don't do well. Policemen under attack don't do well. In both these situations, we want to support them and require more of them. Bad behavior cannot be tolerated. Good behavior should be rewarded is something that Ralph said I think is correct. And it was interesting. I did read an article that was kind of pointing at police unions. And frequently people on the right point to teacher unions, not at teachers, but the unions that prevent the bad actors from being held accountable. And it seems like a cultural thing going on where we have these institutions that are protecting themselves and in addition, and in doing so become worse. I also see a cultural issue where, you know, we're so worried about people saying something wrong that the whole adage I heard in kindergarten, which is, you can break my bones, but words will never hurt me, does not seem to be in our consciousness anymore. Well, where words are used by media and others to inflame, and we have the right to inflame to respond to words. The horrible thing about this situation is a lot worse than words, but I'm concerned about our resilience and our forgiveness as a society. And thinking about how do you correct that? How do you go there? And it's interesting, in the Giuliani case in New York, he could get rid of a lot of policemen that weren't up to standards because he had credibility with the police, just like Nixon could go to China, but somebody else probably couldn't. Maybe there is an opportunity for a leader that unexpectedly supports the police or unexpectedly supports the rights of the African Americans who are under a horrible situation here. It does seem, in a weird way, to not only be a result of a lot of issues, but to almost a more fundamental problem in our society today, where sanity is lost, where people aren't held accountable for, aren't rewarded for good behavior, or aren't held accountable for bad behavior, and trying to avoid all those uncomfortable conversations, we actually make matters worse. My hope here is that so many people do want to make it better, that we actually take actions that actually do lead to that conclusion, and not reactionary towards or anger or behaving poorly towards anger. Anger is justified. With those observations and no answer, I will stop.
More questions. We love it. Okay, the order here is Katie, then Joan, then Ralph.
All right. This is kind of similar to what John just said. I recently did a little survey myself. I surveyed 10 white women who were similar to my age, and I asked them, if you were walking towards your car and turned around and saw a white man following you, would you be as uncomfortable if it was a black man? And 100%, it was no. And that is incredibly telling. And I guess I've been doing some reflection on what in our lives up to this point has created the mindset that so many of us are currently in or can't even help sometimes. Like, it's so ingrained that it's like, yeah, I would be more scared of a black man following me. And it's like, why? I mean, it's totally crazy, and it might have to do with growing up, all I saw were on the TV of criminals were black males, and when white men were partying, it was described as having fun and getting rowdy, and if a group of young black males were doing something, it was considered looting and gang activity. And that's how it's been for an incredibly long time. And the other thing I wanted to say is I want people to recognize that fear is so a part of this. That I wish people could openly say, I'm afraid. I wish police officers could openly say that I'm afraid. You know, in the video that I watched of where a police officer shot a young black man, the tone in his voice was like utmost fear. And I just wish that we could like own up to that part of ourselves. Because I think so much of the way we react comes from that deep sense of fear and learning how to move past that, but you can't move past it until you've recognized it. And that's what I got. Thanks.
This is Joan. I heard I was next on the list. I am going to continue on there's many things I could say, but the theme of fear is a really core one in what's going on. And as a member of Moms Rising, I'm just so attuned for how terrifying it is to have your child, your growing child, out on the street and be fearful that the police are going to do harm to them. It's terrifying. And that's the space that there's being fearful for yourself, but being fearful for your child is just another level of powerlessness. And I think the reason why so many people are showing up and saying this has got to change, and why I think we collectively want to stand and help make that change happen. And my other fear is that our polarization will interfere with our capacity to do that, because it's interfered with our capacity to create so many solutions. And I'm hoping that there's enough clarity in the end goal that we can make this one of those exceptions, where I think one of the reasons things are getting better in the criminal justice area is because there is right-left consensus that there are too many people in prison, and the war on drugs has not been a success. And we need to use evidence-based practices. And there's so much more I could say, but I know there's only limited time, so I will leave it to Ralph now. Go ahead, Ralph.
I'm getting used to my role as the skunk at the garden party, but I hate to break the good news to everybody, but I'll do it anyway. Resolving this is a lot easier than we're making it sound. Number one, John Gable is right, okay? The power to resolve this quickly and dramatically is in the mayors, and we have power over our mayors. So let's not get, let's be very specific and practical. The second item is high schools were invented as a mandatory thing back in the 1930s to take young men off of the labor market. So heads of families who were back then exclusively male could get the jobs rather than having 14-year-old boys take the jobs. That works in a suburban and affluent context. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that people from the inner city community not be required to go to school. But right now, they are locked out of the labor market, the after-school labor market, the vacation labor market. And they are not subsidized by their parents the way suburban kids are subsidized. And this creates an absolutely stultifying effect whereby one of my inner city activist friends says, the inner city kids are trapped for drug dealing, jail, and death, and they know it. And I believe it. In fact, I know that it's true. That's that artifact of the Great Depression can be transformed and reformed in a way that could dramatically shift the quality of life in your cities and dramatically reduce crime. The third thing is, and this goes back to something that Joan said, we don't socialize blacks and whites, or whites and people of color. Allen Ginsberg, the great poet, back in the 1960s, noticed that the hippies and the Hells Angels loathed each other. The hippies were anti-Vietnam War and the Hells Angels were pro-Vietnam War. And he said, you know, they're both marginalized communities. If we can get them partying together, they will fall in love with each other and they will become fast friends and mutual defenders. And so he invited them to one of Ken Kesey's electric Kool-Aid acid tests and they partied together and they fell in love with each other and they became fast friends. Forevermore, and their respective disagreements about the Vietnam War were no longer a toxic factor. It was just a thing. They became extremely devoted to one another, two marginalized communities. A simple and pleasant way of resolving this would be through socializing. And nobody does it, and nobody's proposing it, and that's a missed opportunity. The last thing is, I'm a cynic. I'm a genial cynic, not an evil cynic. We cynics, going back to the cynic school of philosophy in ancient Greece, believe that people do things because they consider it's for their own best interest, not because it's the right thing. And there's only decisive evidence over all of recorded history, over all the world, that this is true. I think there's something perverse at work that I would like to resolve. The African American community is a source of incredible riches, spiritual, cultural and intellectual riches, that by walling them off and marginalizing them and oppressing them, the white community is denying itself this treasure trove which it doesn't realize exists. I also think that there's something paternalistic about saying, we need to treat blacks better. Look, it's as much as in our interest to treat blacks with the dignity they deserve as it is in the blacks' interests in a curious kind of way. And yes, it's the right thing to do, but for God's sake, let's not be paternalistic about it. Let's say we're shooting ourselves in the foot by marginalizing the African American community. We want to open our doors because it's in our interest, not simply because it's the right thing to do. And so I'd like to put in a word against paternalism and in favor of opening our eyes the way Debbie Lynn says her eyes opened, and to realize that there's something much bigger and richer going on here that we should embrace. The end.
Thanks, Mel. We just have a few minutes here to wrap up. So I'm going to collapse our rounds 4 and 5 that are on the website, livingroomconversations.org. Under topics, look for criminal justice reform, and then you'll find police-community relations if you want to have this conversation yourself. But rounds four and five are reflections and accomplishments and next steps. So let's do that all in kind of one last go around before we end our conversation today. So learnings, new understandings, changed perceptions, acknowledgments, what you think we accomplished here, and then the next step. Let's start with Katie.
All right. I think this conversation is amazing. I've said this before about other, you know, large scale conversations we've had. There's so much more to talk about. And I hope that these conversations continue and that anyone who's listening chooses to have their own conversation about this as well. And I feel like the next time we have this, or in the future, it would be good to bring somebody of color onto the call to give a more diverse perspective on this subject. The next steps for me, I do agree with what Ralph and John have said about talking to mayors and elected officials about this issue and continuing to talk with your friends, neighbors, and people that you would not normally speak with. And that is advice to myself. I'm out with that, actually. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Katie. in reverse order this time, John Gable, what about your reflections and next steps?
I'm feeling a broader civility cultural challenge in America where it seems that the deeper we go in something even as horrific and specific as this, the more common the problem is, or the more widespread the problem is, the more core to the way our culture and our, has grown to be more in bubbles separated from each other, both through technology and through natural sorting of in time. And this conversation actually energizes me to focus more on that core problem and how to solve it, because that's what we've all been focused on in so many different ways. And I will also mention that since Ferguson, I've only been seeing things getting worse and worse and worse and worse, and been predicting them getting worse, and unfortunately seeing them getting worse. I will say that in a weird way, I don't feel that way here, though I can share some of Debbie Lynn's feelings about it became more real. Because I actually saw more examples of leaders and others coming together than I had seen before. And that's a cause for hope.
Thanks, John. Joan.
Really valued hearing the different perspectives of what, you know, we all see such different parts of this and a huge amount to look at. I did want to say when Ralph said nobody's suggesting the kind of getting together and having and talking. We are living room conversations, and I think that's what this call is suggesting. So just a note there. I like the mayor's part. I know there are some really good programs that have been started. There are good examples out there, and I think we have to make a concerted effort to talk to people, yes, and lift up the programs that are working and develop more programs that are and create it's a very multifaceted response that's going to be helpful, and I really appreciate that I get to explore this with, you know, such a diverse group of partners. Thank you.
Thanks, Joan.
I'm sorry I wasn't clearer, Joan. Yes, Living Room Conversations, livingroomconversations.org, is all about getting together and having these conversations. I was talking about getting together for fun, for parties, socializing. As you know, my motto is capitalize with a capitalist, but socialize with the socialists. They throw much better parties. And so I just, you know, think that the idea of, you said this earlier, and by the way, Saul Alinsky has made very profoundly the comparable point. When people don't actually know each other, okay, once they know each other, it changes, it creates a completely different personal chemistry, a friendly personal chemistry rather than an adversarial personal chemistry. So I'm just calling for us to call on the mayors to pull together, you know, rockin' parties with blacks and whites and cops and citizens and stuff like that, just to socialize. They'll have conversations in the course of that. So forgive me, I'm just a party animal. And with that, I'm out.
Thanks, Ralph. Jacob. Reflections and next steps.
I'm not sure it will be as easy as Ralph portrayed. I wish it was. I would love to believe that, Ralph. I'm left with a question. Like, I'm curious about the difference between the healthy empathy raising and sensitivity you described, Debbie Lynn, and what I have observed and worried about, sort of an unhealthy sensitivity that primes the pump for chronic grievance and microaggression obsession. Like, I don't know that, not sure what the difference is between the two, but I'm going to be thinking about that. In the near term, I am more pessimistic that I'm expecting the separation from resentment even and this violence.
Hey, Jacob, I'm going to ask you to hold your phone a little bit differently and start over because we're getting some distortion on your end.
Sorry.
I
must have been holding over the microphone. So just say, I do believe that there are real answers to this, and our group is exploring something that really does help detox people. In the near term, I'm less optimistic because I don't see masses of people really moving towards cultivating these kinds of
spaces and this kind of relationship. So I do actually fear, Katie, I fear that the separation will grow, the violence will continue and escalate, and in the near term, things are going to be tough. The hope that I do have is that in the long term, I'm among those who, you know, believe there's a God overseeing this all, who will join us on the scene at some point and set us straight, kind of help us reorient what we're doing, and welcome all the peacemaking efforts that we've been trying to do. That's when things will really get fun, and I'm not mentioning to get to the root. I have little fundamental hope that in the meanwhile we're going to really do what it takes to get to the root. I believe it's possible, and we're not moving that direction. Sorry. Anyway.
Thanks, Jacob. I'll close out here. I think I really like what a couple of you have offered about the police accountability and in addition to supporting the police department. And I think building the relationship, you know, both the serious conversations and the social time where we actually get to mingle and like each other is imperative. And I want to challenge myself and all of us on the call that if we're in a situation, I mean, I've seen the school lunchrooms, right? All the white kids eat together and all the black kids eat together. I want to challenge us if we have an opportunity to reach into our soul and do what's uncomfortable and go talk to people who are not like us. And I know lots of people on this call are up for that, but that's definitely a next step for me. I do have lots of Black Lives Matter friends and people of color from across the country, but I haven't talked with them about this yet. I've been really focusing my work on engaging with folks I know who are less sympathetic and kind of want to maintain the status quo, which is a very inequitable system. So I'm going to continue that work as well for my next steps. And other than that, I think we should just congratulate ourselves on another successful living room conversation with multiple, many, many points of view. I love everything that was said here. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Have a good day, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been Living Room Conversations, courtesy of Coffee Party USA Radio. You can learn more at coffeepartyusa.com, and make sure to click on that big red button that says Become a Member. Coffee Party USA is 100% volunteer and member supported. That's you. So thanks for listening. Make it a great day.